docket is Christina Robinson versus Madison County Department of Social Services. Ms. Kagan, Ms. Tinsley, Ms. Lowe. You may come up. Bear with me. I don't know if you were in here earlier when I made the announcements. We are enjoying the hospitality of Lexington Rockingham County Courthouse here today. We don't have timers, so I'm using my built-in iPad timer. I will try to give you a heads up when you reach your time reserved for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
But you're going to have to give me a minute to unlock here. All right, Ms. Kagan, you wish to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, sir. I would prefer to reserve 3 minutes, and I believe I have 8 total.
I'm sorry. We've actually got 3 cases here, and what we're going to do is we're going to hear the Robinson versus Madison DSS first, and that will be 2 15-minute arguments, just like a regular appeal, because the issue is distinct and different from the Wright versus DSS cases. We will hear that case, those 2 cases together, Janet Wright and Jimmy Wright, and that will be a 40-minute argument, so each side will have 20 and can split it however they want to do it.
Okay, I misunderstood the docket when it was sent to me and had all 3 cases at the same time and said 40 minutes.
We've moved them around a little bit. The issues were different.
Oh, yes.
Excuse me, Ms. Lowe?
Yes, sir.
You are joining in with DSS.
That's correct.
And in both of those cases, the two of you can decide, or two of you back can decide if you want to split any of the time available to the appellee.
Okay.
But it will be it'll be a total of 15 minutes, second case, total of 20 minutes.
Thank you.
Everybody understand?
Yes, sir. I apologize for my early confusion.
No,
I think I'd like to reserve 5 minutes then, if I've got 15 total.
What am I doing here wrong? Hold on. Okay. Oh, be seated.
Thank you.
All right. We're ready. 15 minutes. You may begin when you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Stephanie Kangan. I was appointed to be the guardian ad litem for Christina Robinson in this termination of parental rights case. The issue is that Ms. Wright was not given any type of notice for this. She was appointed a guardian ad litem when she was in jail. She, in between docket call and...
Now you say guardian ad litem. I'm assuming you are effectively counsel
Yes.
for her. All right.
Yes, she was not appointed separate counsel. She was released after docket call. The letter that I had sent to her...
Released by the jail? Or
yes.
Prison? I don't know.
Jail. She was at the Central Virginia Regional Jail in Orange. She was released from jail. The letter that I had sent to her came back to me. And so I was not able to get in touch with her. She did not get in touch with me after she was released. I did not have any kind of forwarding address for her because the place where she had been living prior to going to jail had been condemned. That was part of the issue with her being in jail.
Was any request for a continuance made based on your inability to communicate with your client?
I don't recall. It's possible that I did not. I will say that, you know, that may not have been my best trial work that day on this because I was thrown off by this. And I probably should have requested it be continued, but I did object to her whether or not she had notice, whether we could go forward without the notice. And I guess when I looked through the case law, the Rader case says that, you know, you need to be very specifically notified of what's going on and what is going to be happening in the court. And I'm arguing to the court that without knowing the when and where, knowing what's happening
but
is kind of
weird. She had notice of these proceedings all the way through the juvenile court, did she not?
Yes, and she was incarcerated from the prior, she was incarcerated when the notice went out, I believe it was late October, that DSS filed the new plan with a goal of adoption and the motions to terminate the parental rights of my client and the father's. She was incarcerated at that time. I requested that she be transported to be able to participate in this hearing. And she did participate in the juvenile court. The juvenile court terminated her parental rights, changed the goal to adoption, and then my client wanted to appeal. I noted the appeal, and...
Did the circuit court ever make, in its hearing, any sort of findings on the best interest of the child?
I believe Ms. Lowe suggested it was in the best interest of the child, but I'm not sure that...
Sorry, say that again.
I think Ms. Lowe, the guardian ad litem, made an argument that it was in the best interest of the child. I don't recall whether the order...
But the court took no action on the petition. The court simply dismissed the appeal and remanded the entire matter back, did it not?
Yes. The
statute allowing the court to remand, to dismiss an appeal, the circuit court to dismiss an appeal, applies where the person appealing does not appear. Did you ever make the argument to the trial court that you were there, that the person appealing made an appearance by counsel, and that there's no requirement in the law that the mother in a termination case has to actually be present in order to go forward?
I probably should have made that, but I did not. As far as the best interest of the child, I would need to review the order, and if I may answer that on rebuttal after I've double-checked the circuit court's order, if that's acceptable to the court. I just don't want to give the wrong answer. I'd rather look it up and be right. My client was appointed at docket call. They reappointed me guardian ad litem. She was serving comeback time for a felony, and she did not have actual notice. The court, I was there in court, but I did not insist that it go forward. And it is a permissive statute as far as that, and I realize that.
Why isn't notice to you as her attorney and agent effective notice to her?
Well, that's what the court found.
Why isn't that a correct ruling?
I think that when I told the court that I was not able to reach my client, that at that point it's somewhat, I think at that point she doesn't really have the information, and at that point she's to some extent,
Which would be pretty good grounds for continuance, but no request for continuance was made. If we were reviewing this on abuse of discretion for failing to continue it, that might be a different kettle.
Right. And I'm not sure that I was thinking about a continuance partially because I knew we were already outside the statutory 90-day. And I think that may have, because of that, I may not have been thinking continuance at that time.
You were concerned that if you went beyond this, that it would be bad for your client.
Not only that, but that requesting a continuance would put it, the court had already found good cause to go basically, I guess, about a month beyond the 90-day statutory requirement. And I wasn't sure that we would, as far as going beyond that, that would be, best for my client, or that, I may have been thinking that it may not even have been granted, but I didn't ask, so.
Who actually filed the notice of appeal in the J&D court?
I did.
And was that ever communicated to your client? Was she aware that that had been appealed?
Yes. I mailed her a copy.
And where was that mailed?
The Central Virginia Regional Jail. I also set it for docket call and filed a precipe, and the certificate of service on that indicates that I mailed it to her, as well as all the other attorneys involved. So she did have notice that it was being set. It was just that after it was set for a hearing, that was where the communication broke down. That what I sent to the jail didn't get to her, and I didn't have information to contact her after she was released.
So at that point, when it was before the court, she was no longer incarcerated. She'd been released.
Right. I think that she'd been in and out once since then. My client, you know, that was part of the issue before the court, was that, you know, she has frequently been in and out of jail.
Well, I come back to, I guess, where I started this discussion. What is it, what case law supports your argument that she was entitled to specific notice as a matter of due process, notice of the date of that hearing, where you had actual notice of that?
Right, and I guess what I'm asking for is, I'm making a good faith effort to expand on the Rader case, that the actual notice is required of the, you know, and service is required on the date on my client for the date and time of the hearing. Certainly there's no law saying that it's not required. But I am asking for an expansion.
What legal principle are we basing that?
It's simple due process, that she have notice of when and where. When and where this will take place, the Rader case, you know, talks about the severity of something like, and all the cases on termination of parental rights, up to the one that came out, I guess, last week, 2 weeks ago, the Welch case, you know, talks about how big of a deal this is, for something that basically is generally irreversible, and making somebody a legal stranger to their children, that due process requirements would require that not only that you know what is happening, which is what the Rader case says, that you know you need very specific notice of this is going to happen, but asking that the court expand that to say that you need specific notice of the when and the where.
All right. You've reached your rebuttal time. If you'd like to reserve the remainder, you may.
Yes, please. Thank you very much. And I will look up the whether the court made a specific finding.
Thank you.
All right. Ms. Tinsley? Are you going to split time here?
Yes, sir.
How much?
Your Honor, I'm asking for 5 minutes.
5 minutes? All right. I'll see if I can keep track of that with my iPad. You may begin.
May it please the court, I'm Deborah S. Tinsley, and I represent Madison Department of Social Services in this appeal. This appeal falls on whether the trial court abused its discretion, and if so, what prejudice was suffered by the appellant. 16.1106.1D clearly leaves discretion with the trial court on whether or not to treat an appeal as withdrawn.
But that only applies if the party fails to appear.
Yes, sir.
She was there by counsel.
Yes, sir.
Why should the statute apply where her attorney made an appearance on her behalf?
Ms. Kangen was her guardian ad litem appointed by the circuit court. The appellant is the mother, Ms. Robinson. She is the party to the proceeding, and she failed to appear.
But there's no requirement that she be present for the hearing to go forward, is there?
No, sir, and that, again, was not raised by the appellant in the trial court. There was no request for a continuance. There had been no request for a transportation order for the appellant, and there had been no explanation as to why the appellant was not present in court.
But if she's not incarcerated, why would there be a transportation order?
When the, first of all, I believe there was notice to the appellant. The appellant received the required notices of 16.1283 and 16.1264 by personal service in the juvenile court. She was present for that proceeding. On that date, she instructed her guardian ad litem to appeal that matter. That notice of appeal was sent by the juvenile court directly to the appellant while she was incarcerated. The matter was then set for first appearance on January 6th.
Is that in the record?
Yes, sir. It's at the bottom of the record that it has her name and her address of where the notice of appeal went. It also has on there in bold that if you fail to appear, your appeal may be withdrawn by the juvenile
court. There's no evidence that she received that, correct?
No, ma'am. It's just
Are you talking about the clerk of the circuit court?
Clerk of the juvenile court. When it set then in December, Ms. Kangen filed a motion, a precipe, and also certified that she sent notice to her client at the Central Virginia Regional Jail. The Madison Circuit Court, if you look at that notice, has an annotation at the bottom that those notices were mailed not only to counsel, but to the appellant. She clearly had notice that these proceedings were going on. She clearly had an indication of the consequences due to the notices of termination that she was served in the lower court, as well as being present in that proceeding and knowing what orders were entered. In addition, a notice that an appeal has been docketed is simply notification of a continuing action in the same case. And if you look at 16.1112, when it says a case is docketed, it's notice to the person not appealing.
Let me ask you about the question I asked Ms. Kangen, and that is, what evidence do we have here that the circuit court made a decision based in any way on the children's best interests?
If you look at the transcript, the judge did allow the guardian ad litem for the children to proffer to the court what was in the best interest of the children. The court indicated, I believe, that the children had been in foster care long enough and it was time to kind of move on and have some finality to the matter.
Did he refer to that in any way in his ruling or order? To the best interest of the child.
I'm trying to remember. I think it's in the order, but I'm not positive. I don't have it in front of me. But again, if the court finds that it is an abuse of discretion, there has to be prejudice to the appellant. And in this case,
We're terminating someone's parental rights.
I agree.
Don't you think we can presume some kind of prejudice if they're not present and able to participate in a hearing of such significant consequences?
Well, resulting prejudice to the appellant must be considered in view of the circumstances unique to the case. And if you look at the case record, particularly in the foster care plans, it shows that the child, TW, never lived with the mother. EW only lived with the mother for 2 years prior to that child being removed by Fauquier County Department of Social Services. In addition, the record reflects that these children don't even know that she's their biological mother. They've never been told. So if you're looking at prejudice from the unique circumstances of the record, I think it's very different than in other cases in which the court has found that TPR by itself is prejudicial to an appellant.
One other thing that interests me about that statute, allowing the dismissal of an appeal, is that if the appellant doesn't appear, should that be construed to only apply where the party who doesn't appear is the party with the burden of going forward with the evidence and the burden of... I'll give you an example. If a criminal defendant, for instance, appeals a conviction in the general district court, and it goes to circuit court, and the defendant doesn't appear, the court doesn't dismiss the appeal. The court tries the case in the absence of the defendant. And here, there was no reason why the court couldn't go forward with the hearing. You had the burden of going forward. You were there. It just seems to me that it'd be a stretch to think the General Assembly intended the kind of consequences that we have in this case.
Well, 16.1106.1D, it's clear, it leaves it to the circuit court or the trial court the discretion to enter an order treating the appeal as withdrawn, and then if the court decides to do that, it says that the court shall enter an order that is consistent with the order entered in the lower court.
All right. You have anything further?
No, sir.
You've got a little time remaining, or your guardian ad litem has a little extra time. Let me ask you to come back. And you may need to clarify this for me. I'm trying to find the notice of appeal that you talked about as being served or sent to the mother. Is that the notice of appeal that's on page 6 of the joint appendix?
I have that on November 25. She was, again, present in the juvenile court. And an appeal, I think it's appendix 828.
828, this is the...
And there's also, I think, on appendix, page 6, I'm sorry.
Page 6 is the notice of appeal.
Yes, sir.
And where does that indicate that it was mailed?
If you're looking at the juvenile one, the notice in the juvenile court, on the side it has the appellant's name and the address at which that notice...
Well, it has name and address, but does it show that it was mailed there? Or are you just assuming that to be the case?
Normal procedure in the juvenile court is that it is then
and
mailed.
You're telling me that normal procedure guarantees that this was mailed?
No, sir. But I guarantee that the appellant was present in the lower court. She instructed her guardian ad litem to appeal.
At what point is
that burden on the appellant to keep up with her own
But
case
she's in jail at the time, is she not?
She was. And she was in jail up to the first appearance when Ms. Kangan appeared on January 6th. She was incarcerated, according to the transcript in Ms. Kangan, through most of January. So there was 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks, that once the case was set on the merits, that she could have received notice from her guardian ad litem that this matter was set for a hearing on the merits.
Thank you very much.
One quick question.
Yes, sir.
So, just follow up on something you mentioned a moment ago. You said that neither child knows that she is their mother.
That's correct.
What do they know about their grandparents? And the grandparents, when they had custody, never indicated that this woman was their mother?
No, sir. I believe in the foster care plans, and there may be a letter from the mother in the record, they refused to allow the kids to be told that she was a biological mother.
Right there. Ms. Lowe?
Thank you. May it please the court. I'm Catherine Ann Lowe. I am guardian ad litem for both Ethan and Troy, and I have been ever since the initial removal back in May of 2012. When this case first began, I think all of us were hopeful that with education and guidance, we might train the grandparents to understand that given the trauma in these children's early life, that they needed to adjust their beliefs. And that did not happen. I am here today.
What do you mean by adjust their beliefs?
It was really interesting, and it's kind of heartbreaking to listen to the Wrights, who are the grandparents, testify. Because the way in which they were raised as children involved a great deal of physical discipline. And I believe that in their case, they did not understand that because the children had been exposed to trauma, removed from their family of origin so quickly, that it may have different effects on these children than it would on other children. And we were very hopeful that if we were to essentially educate them on the ideas of trauma and attachment and how to move forward, that we might be able to return these children to their family. And unfortunately, that did not happen. I am here on behalf of the children to ask the court to go ahead and affirm the decision below. Because if you think about it from the concept of these children, they were removed 30 months ago and counting. For Ethan, that is a full 26% of his lifetime.
Why did DSS, why did it take them so long to do anything about the mother's rights? You're forgetting about the grandparents.
Right. Well, when we originally went to court, the original goal was return to mother. Unfortunately, this poor woman has a history that she gets out of jail, immediately reoffends, and is reincarcerated. So very quickly it became apparent that within that 1 year time that we have to find a permanent solution for children, that she would be unable to correct her own housing needs, employment needs, much less begin to work on dealing with the trauma that these children had suffered. So we very quickly moved to the goal of relative placement. Okay? Now,
but didn't include in their termination parental rights?
Yes. I mean, ultimately, we knew that if relative placement didn't work, that would become the next goal. There are a very limited number of goals you can look at in foster care cases. It's interesting in that one of the reasons for termination for the mother, her own history of incarceration, homelessness, abuse of children, is very much so what the attachment clinic predicted for Ethan and Troy because of their own difficulties in forming attachments. So it's almost as if we were concerned that the mother's own life was predictive of what might happen to these children if we were to return them to the grandparents. The attachment clinic actually says in its report that it would take 12 to 18 months, and this is on the record, the joint appendix at page 511. It says 12 to 18 months working at the two-hour sessions, but, or 4 hours per week.
But none of that is the issue before us. The issue before us is simply whether there should have been a hearing by the trial court, the circuit court.
Correct.
Everything that went on in J&D court is a nullity at this point, or would be if the trial court had proceeded.
Well, it is if you determine that you need to decide whether or not the dismissal was appropriate under the statute. In order to defeat that, they would have to prove that there was an abuse of discretion and that it gave rise to a prejudice. And what I'm saying is there is no prejudice because the circumstances of both the mother's life and the grandparents' life is such that it was at that point very nearly incurable within a relative period of time. We've already gone to 2 years. If they are predicting another 12 to 18 months to correct the current problem, we are so outside the statutory guide work that it doesn't make any sense. The problem, and you mentioned your concerns about the grandparents' decision to not tell the children that their mother was their mother. And if you look at the joint appendix at 229, you'll get a history from the mother that my siblings and myself were abused and called names when we were being raised by the Wrights. When I visited my children, the few times the Wrights allowed me to do so, they had to call me Tina, not Mom. And I had to act like a family member. I asked Miss Wright why. She said, so the boys are not confused. And then on page 230, if you look at the joint appendix on page 229, it's a letter that the mother wrote to Judge Barry that was admitted into evidence.
Ms. Lowe, your time has expired, although you will have some more time in the next case.
Understand. Thank you.
Pick it up from there at that point. Thank you very much. I think we'll go ahead and consider these next two cases because everybody's the same, and then we'll. I'm sorry, Ms. Kagan. Then I guess we will greet counsel.
And I think that.
She had some rebuttal time.
I apologize.
That's okay, and I believe that.
You have 5 minutes remaining.
And Judge Beals, correct? Did not get his question answered, and I promised to answer it on rebuttal, which is probably why he was most concerned about it. I reviewed the order. The order of, it's page 470 through 473 in the joint appendix, and there was no specific finding there. I also reviewed the transcript.
No specific finding.
That termination and change in goal was in the best interest of the children.
Okay.
There was, Ms. Lowe made a proffer to the court in the transcript, but the court did not make a finding that dismissing the case and remanding it to the juvenile court was in the best interest of the children. So there was no specific finding either in the written order or in the transcript. As far as any other things, I think I would probably just be repeating myself, but I did want to get that question answered. I know I have 5 minutes if the court has any other questions. As far as this goes, I think that extending it to either, my argument was that she needed specific notice for due process, but also that the trial court should not have dismissed it and should have made, had social services prove their case, allowed cross-examination by all the parties, and if at that point make the finding that under 16.1283 that it was in the best interest to change the goal of the children, change the goal, foster care goal for the children, excuse me, and to terminate the parental rights if that was also in the best interest of the children. So I will, I guess, to some extent, modify what I was saying, that I do think she needed actual notice, but even if the court finds that she did not, that because there was no finding that it was in the best interest of the child, as simply dismissing it and remanding it without making that finding was an error.
All right, thank you very
much.
Thank you. Let's just move on. I assume you're gonna remain for this next case?
Yes.
Okay. We'll greet counsel all at once then in a matter of efficiency. We'll take up the next case, the next two cases, Janet Wright versus Madison DSS and Jimmy Wright versus Madison DSS.